Ladies and gentlemen, John Gatto.
I want to congratulate all of you and the Hope people for 20 years of the most exciting populist revolution this country has ever seen. I think the Hope people are a blessing in you as well. The talk this morning, which I literally finished 28 minutes ago, I arrived at this hotel 2 days ago and I instantly asked, is there a Staples around? Raced up, bought a typewriter, and I've been sitting up in my room. I came with a whole lot of notes and a prepared talk, but sometimes when you meet people, you get a sense of how far you can go, how honest you can be, and I said, I've got to be a lot more honest. But the title has remained the same, and that's Bianca, You Animal, Shut Up, or Education as a Helix Sport. That got added after I got here. And Bianca, You Animal, Shut Up is a cry I actually heard. The voice echoes in my ears like the shriek of a banshee proclaiming the murder of 6-year-old Bianca's spirit, even though her body continues to shuffle around somewhere harvesting sugar cane or whatever it is Bianca's do when voodoo school teachers finish with them. To a casual onlooker, nothing at all happened. Only another red-faced school administrator putting a little brat in her place to the intense merriment of her classmates. If you went to public school yourself, you've seen the scene many, many times. Why should your happy little Nancy, who homeschools, think about miserable Bianca? I can't put my finger on it exactly, but I keep getting this flash forward of your Nancy as a grown woman waking up in a world where Bianca is the meter maid or the passport clerk or the strange lady next door. I picture this animal Bianca grown large and mean, the same Bianca who didn't go to school for a month after her little friends took to whispering, Bianca is an animal, Bianca is an animal, while Bianca, only a moment ago a human being, sat in tears, struggling with a reading selection she was ordered to guess her way through, and a perfect model of modern holistic methodology. In my fantasy, unbeknown to your own Dick and Jane, Bianca is thinking, you bastard, you look like the fiend who made my life hell. Now it's your turn. And so vengeance-driven is she that, one, she gives Nancy's car a ticket before the meter runs out, which a parking meter maid informed me one day in a bar that she always did to meet her quota. Two, she throws Nancy's passport application in the trash after Nancy leaves the office. Three, she plays Malagueña over and over demonically through the thin partition wall which separates her apartment bedroom from Nancy's, while Nancy pounds helplessly on the wall for relief. And four, all of the above. What pedagogues do to kids in the name of education isn't as simple as filling empty vessels. Figuring out what actually happens is an act of intellect and intellection, the removal of things to larger frames of reference to examine them three-dimensionally. That's a major dividing line between public schooling and the best education in schools such as we might find at Groton or St. Paul's. Stuyvesant High and Hollywood High are pretty good at cranking out problem solvers to fill slots at Reynolds Tobacco or Blockbuster Video, but they haven't much patience with intellect, although sometimes you find a maverick teacher here and there who contradicts the recipe for public schooling, as it is called. I was a teacher like that for 30 years, not out of any superior morality or intellectual pretension, but because I had been raised not to accept money without delivering something of value in return. With age, I've come to realize that dumbing children down is useful to a certain kind of class-based command economy. But when I began teaching, I assumed erroneously that I worked directly for the parents and their children. That error made me a guerrilla school teacher without consciously willing it. Unlike intelligence or creative intuition, your child cannot easily assemble an intellect in these days of universal deception. Its building blocks are somewhat tricky to drag together when several major social institutions have a stake in preventing that. It seems essential to me that older people assist in the awakening of this dimension, nor is there opportunity, in most cases, to do it democratically or holistically. It will only happen by steeping children like tea bags in the world of great problems, great minds, invisible connections, and interconnections. That doesn't mean your family has to give up trashy movies or sugar that rots your teeth. I hope not. Or Woman's Wear Daily. But it does mean that those things even need contexts against which to gauge their effects. Everything is grist for the mill of intellect. To see what your kid will be up against in the 21st century and why he or she needs an intellect, I want to turn your attention from Bianca for a second and deposit you in multicultural Romania in the Orwellian year of 1984, where, if you listen carefully, you will hear loudspeakers crackling, "Romanians, you animals, shut up." By 1984, the political state of Romania was entering the lives of its citizens in minute, therapeutic detail. The government dictated how many calories each person must consume daily according to their occupation, how much soap they must use to keep themselves clean, how powerful the light bulbs must be in every socket, what temperature was permissible inside dwellings at different hours of the day, and many more scientifically sensible prescriptions of what we call freedom. A national systematization program was underway. Villages by the hundreds were leveled all over Romania, and their citizens transshipped into massive apartment blocks, similar to the bleak, ultra-high-rise concrete things one sees everywhere in Beijing and indeed everywhere in Asia. The Romanian government rehoused itself in gigantic fantasy buildings larger than the Pentagon on a scale to dwarf the individual, either the individual supplicant or the individual Romanian employee. The explanation for the suddenness of that country's transformation was that it was a dictatorship. But by 1984, the United States had turned down the same road Romania was on, and to the naked eye, it was not a dictatorship, even though in the United States, changes were presumably uncoordinated and voluntary. Regional differences in American continental society were vanishing rapidly. Speech, locomotion, dress, housing, nutrition, and schooling were virtually identical wherever you went, and from our versions of loudspeakers poured constant exhortations about diet, toothpaste, child-rearing, recycling, and what attitudes to hold dear. The two-party political system had come suspiciously to resemble a one-party system. Whether in prison, on parole, or as ex-cons, America boasted by far the highest percentage of people identified by the label criminal of any nation on earth. The tax burden on an average citizen in 1984, when all levies were added, exceeded 50%, compared to a figure of 5% just 40 years earlier. To such a degree had free will choice been prescribed by the American state. And there was more. A small handful of corporations, 23 in actuality, had come to control the entire flow of public information coast to coast. The press is a resonator of the American argument, which is the essence of political democracy's resistance to tyranny. A working, healthy democracy is not about protecting the rights of the majority. It's about protecting the rights of the minority. And if you look at the Bill of Rights, that's a list of rights that are put above and beyond the reach of the electorate. You may not prescribe somebody's freedom of speech. You may not prescribe their right to bear arms. And there are eight others, their right to assemble, and so on. Whatever disputation was still tolerated in America in 1984, or in 1984 Boston, you can be sure that the nominal adversaries ate at the same clubs, vacationed at the same spas, read the same periodicals, intermarried, and were alumni of the same schools. With the public argument dying, and without intellect as a compass, there is no easy way for a young man or woman to navigate rationally in postmodern America, where nothing is exactly what it seems. Power in America has been displaced from its traditional locations into mystery, almost as if this were ancient Sparta, where serious decisions were similarly made in secret, even though there was a publicly elected legislature and executive. Formal schooling colludes in this amputation of mind. Even the best have been set up to function mostly like Realschulen in Germany, as adequate assembly lines for engineers, school teachers, doctors, or middle managers, but not very good at exposing the trick of policy making so that people can make policy for themselves. And as for the worst schools, it is hardly a secret these days that schools are not about teaching the road to comprehensive thought. Only a few catering to the prosperous or even about fractional thinking, the kind specialists do. That explains an educational reality where schools are the workplaces for science teachers who have never conducted a single original scientific experiment in their lives, nor have any interest in doing so, of math teachers with only the shakiest grasp of the practical uses of number, of social studies teachers with no knowledge whatsoever of economics or political science or history or anything save a smattering of light-duty psychological advice, and finally of English teachers who read very little themselves, write not at all, have no ability or interest in rhetoric, and could not prosecute an argument successfully if their lives depended upon it. In every school there are teachers, of course, who contradict this model, but I've just described the norm in government schooling, whether good government schooling or bad. The teacher certification monopoly has nothing whatsoever to do with the mastery of an intellectual discipline. Indeed, every year, many competent people are denied admission to the business or forced out of it because they know too much. Throughout history, intellectual thinking of the highest order, much of it preserved in books that are still available, allowed leaders of the highest order to see behind closed doors, to look into the future. Looking at the past, an intellect finds not boring stories, but a laboratory of human nature, sees useful experiments where sloppy minds find only dull words. An intellectual mind deduces from historical events plans and motives invisible to mere intelligence. It divines purpose at work. Intellect understands the indirect guidance of events through contingencies, understands how public opinion is deliberately shaped unawares, sees how social dialectics can be used to divide and conquer an opposition without a shot fired. If you read de Tocqueville, you will be unable to comprehend how he could foresee so accurately the America that you and I live in long before it happened, unless you have trained your intellect. By 1900, a colossal social management scheme was underway behind the scenes in America. That's why we got effective forced schooling when we did. Really, you can only date this business back to about 1905, although you can find stirrings and local experiments up to a century before. But in 1905, the police were called in to enforce the new compulsion laws. This industry had studied social control at the feet of Plato and Hobbes, Rousseau and Comte, but it learned best the lesson taught by the Prussian genius George Hegel, that the mechanism of historical change was actually accessible to human manipulation. Men who understood could control and steer history. But to do this with efficiency, effective randomness, excessive randomness, what you and I might call conscience, would have to be squeezed out of the system. If you presume to be the conscience of everyone, competition cannot be allowed. Just as the prime meaning of school is embedded in the word itself, just so the word system should always signal to you a place where free will is unwelcome and indeed disbelieved as a possibility. The device to do Hegel's bidding would be a mass forced schooling system. Traditionally, secrets of intellect have been the property of aristocrats and of the privileged priesthoods they pay to do the thinking for them. There has never existed a time or place when unauthorized intellection was taken kindly, although classical Greece, Elizabethan England, and late colonial and early federal America sometimes come close to being exceptions. Peasants have been taught by their betters to harass intellect and to report it to proper authorities. I had a marvelous instance of this self-policing against the growth of intellect dropped in my lap a month ago by Pat Ferenga, the head of the John Holt Organization, who's a dear friend, in the form of a Syracuse PhD thesis. Where are you, Pat? Is Pat in the room? Pat loaned me a thesis called Prosperous Illiterates, and I read it carefully, and the point of the essay was that literacy has been vastly overrated as an avenue to competence and advancement in the workplace. And I'm inclined to agree with that proposition precisely, that literacy has been overrated as an asset in the workplace, not that literacy has been overrated. But hidden inside the thesis that Pat loaned me was a buried plan for social action aimed at the employing class. Our author, in attempting to convince employers of a rationale to prefer illiterates, said this: employees who read too well leave the job more quickly, request wage increases at the drop of a hat, score low on job satisfaction, engage in union activities, and make private use of company property. Illiterates, on the other hand, show more company loyalty, job satisfaction, strong work ethics, and high moral standards, which mean that you don't take the stamps home from work. Am I imagining things, or is this a good, sound case for dumbed-down schooling from a managerial perspective? Do you really think that history had to await a PhD thesis at Syracuse to make this discovery? It's only when the point of view is shifted away from the needs of industrial and social managers to the needs of individual spirits for dignity and growth that a new calculus emerges in which literacy is a blessing, but you need an intellect to make that argument. No matter what else seems to be going on, a large part of the strategy of my teaching was to force the classroom discourse onto the great canvases of intellect. Whether the project in question was planning how two girls might break through the tight security at New Yorker magazine in order to interview legendary editor William Shawn, who never gave interviews until Caitlin and her friend Mary got one, or scheming how to beard the mayor of New York, that was Ed Koch, in his den without an appointment, or simply trying to deduce how our fellow student Caitlin had figured out that by tossing her long blonde hair out of her eyes several hundred times an hour, she could command every ounce of male attention in the room, including mine. But I saw to it that all these matters, whatever, were framed intellectually. What degree of intensity did I employ with 13-year-old kids? Exactly the same degree I'm inflicting on you. I speak to everyone on earth exactly the same way, and certainly young children often burst into tears. Whether kids were rich or poor, bright or dumb, I spoke to them exactly as I am speaking to you. Historically, a maverick or two, like Spartacus or Jesus or Wat Tyler, would figure out how the trick of social power really was managed. Here or there, someone would figure out why MIT students always end up under the thumb of Yale students, or why when Bill Gates and the Sultan of Brunei are the two richest men in the world, neither has any real power. But by the early 20th century, a gigantic system was fast coming together to seal off the control modules of the society from popular access, as they were sealed off in other lands by tradition or strong social class barriers. To borrow Langdon Winner's term, and if you're really looking for a read that'll cause your hair to stand on end, get Langdon Winner's book from the MIT bookstore, Autonomous Technology. It was written about 25 years ago, but it's kept constantly in print. To borrow Langdon Winner's term, the direction of human affairs was becoming a piece of autonomous social technology, by which Winner means that it appears to be under the direction of certain men and women, but if those people deviate from the system's requirements, out they go. The system has built-in protections, and someone else who will appear to be directing the machine is put into place. Now, this machine is kept in repair by an army of well-paid technocrats with ample intelligence, but they lack the intellect to understand what they are actually doing. If this sounds confusing or even confused, try to remember that we got the Central Intelligence Agency not from Dick Nixon, but from Harry Truman, and we got the FBI not from Herbert Hoover, but from Teddy Roosevelt. Try to divine what those entrails really mean. I can only speculate how the imperative to pound Bianca into powder before she inherited her intellect came to be. But my suspicion is that the printing press was the chief culprit. If you're skeptical that mere books could be any threat to the secrets of power, consider these few examples. Would you like to think and scheme as a prince does? You could, you know, after Machiavelli blew the prince's cover in 1519. Now you, too, could screw your colleagues following the prescriptions of a master psychologist. Are you disgusted with lining up in endless rituals of supplication to placate authorities who have no actual authority, but are only there to keep you from getting to the real boss? Thomas Hobbes could show you how the worm of power conceals itself and how to beard it in its real den with an offer it won't be able to refuse. You need to read Leviathan, written in 1620. Or are you weary of things as they are? Would you like to give the entire planet a complete makeover? Hegel, at the University of Berlin, had doped out a phenomenal formula by 1810 to turn power inside out, and it worked. The sons of every prominent family in the United States traveled to Germany during the 19th century in order to study this amazing discovery, and a number of others. But Hegel certainly was king of the court. He was the Michael Jordan of his day. Perhaps you might even aspire, following Hegel, to stop history in its tracks at the precise spot you wanted it stopped. I realize that to people who wake up in the morning and smile when they see the sun and walk their dog, all this sounds like fantasy. But let me tell you, at Skull and Bones at Yale or in private men's clubs or in a number of places where people don't walk the dog, they do talk about these things. You see the problem, don't you? The printing press threatened to spread the trick of intellect too far and too wide. No order of power could survive this transition from a world where almost nobody thought into one where everybody could. Something had to be done. Once the literacy cat is out of the bag, freed by the printing press, there's no point in wasting energy stopping the mob from learning how to read. Like a well-trained army, you fall back to a different position from which to torment the rabble. What you now attempt is a variety of misdirections. First, convincing the enemy that the real value of reading is reading for information, for facts, when you know full well that is a much lesser use of the art, one for which clerks can be hired, and simultaneously you downgrade the overall value of reading, just as you heard an innocent PhD at Syracuse University do a few minutes ago. If you want a more intellectual downgrading, you need only turn to John Dewey or every single one of the other fathers of 20th century schooling, and most of the holistic saints as well, to discover that reading too well promotes too much independence, prevents the growth of world peace and other goals of a well-socialized humanity. I know the inferences which inevitably flow from this sort of a presentation must sound to many of you of a piece with catching a spaceship out of Rancho Mirage, California, which I understand they caught. But let me on the net it said they caught it. But let me just show you one humble example of the panic with which America's social managers once viewed literacy in Boston, in the hopes of engendering a suspension of your disbelief. In the first half of the 17th century, a 24-year-old servant girl landed in Boston from Ireland, carrying a trunk of real books in her possession. I think the number was 100, which was more books than were publicly available in the whole colony, but I'm not certain of the number. But it was a lot of them. And by real books, I mean to indicate they were neither romance novels or the ravings of Carl Sagan. This girl was instantly arrested and restrained, then shipped off into slavery in the island of Jamaica on the first available boat. Her only crime was those books. Closer to today, there is the case of an overage Peruvian immigrant in Southern California who in the 1970s discovered that Mexican slum children and the riffraff from black ghettos in Los Angeles, get this, had an unquenchable instinct for solving advanced calculus problems. I kid you not, inside of 4 years, using a teaching method discredited by the math establishment then and today, which had been written by a man who flunked calculus 3 times himself in college, this immigrants' classes of underclasses were passing the California Advanced Calculus Placement exams at the highest rate of any school in California and the third best single school record in the United States, public or private. Except for the intense press coverage this success focused on Jaime Escalante, I suspect he would still be teaching at Garfield High today. Jillian Strayhorn needs an older Strayhorn. So I think Escalante would still be at work at Garfield High today, except for the press coverage he got. But while a Hollywood movie was being made about this miracle, his colleagues, together with his school administration, so severely damaged his reputation with parents and prospective students through gossip, secret phone calls and letters, and the skillful use of an army of harassment tools available to any school principal, that he left the school. Was the school culture overreacting to treat Jaime Escalante this way? Of course not. They understood on some level that the social order they represented in their humble jobs could not survive the advent of too many calculus wizards named Pablo and Darnell. To give them their due, the folks who ruined Escalante, that is, you need to think before mindlessly shouting racists or muttering about human envy. You need to credit them with their true function as white corpuscles defending the system which nourishes them, defending it against the deadly virus of intellect. If you would effectively support our Escalantes, you need an understanding that transcends the demonization of our opponents in order to establish clearly what the real combat is. Only then, I think, can we make the most of our strength and the adversary's weakness. We must stop fencing with shadows, but this can only be done by people familiar with the difference between intelligence and intellect, a discrimination we have all been discouraged from acquiring by the structure of public schooling. The first modern nation, I've already apologized to the British citizens in this room, so you don't need to feel, oh, he's done it again. The first modern nation to put effective, deliberate organizational constraint on the general development of intellect was England under the Tudors. The subsequent intellectual holocaust the English have inflicted through time across the whole planet was quite purposeful. It did not happen by accident. Wherever the English language has gone, a strategy of mass stupidification moved in its train. Wherever the British flag sailed, calculated stupidity followed. England became the world capital of all justified programs of dumbing the commons down. Only England could produce on demand a dazzling rainbow of arguments, religious arguments, mathematical arguments, scientific arguments, philosophical arguments, sociological arguments, and aesthetic arguments to explain why Bianca had to shut up. A palette of strategies to prevent the common classes from thinking and from having any independent conscience that mattered. England remains the nanny state rampant, but accepted its first true rival in the early 19th century with the rise of Prussian forced government schooling, the world's first effective true mass compulsion schooling scheme under the direct management of a political state. The secrets of deliberate mind minimization now belonged to two close blood cousins, neither of whom was shy about practicing their application. One of the formidable barriers to achieving a vantage point is for mass schooling. Prejudice aside, there is nothing else mass schooling can be than exercises in one of those three areas or combination. Not facing that causes much muddy thinking and unnecessary grief. All theories of education extant, there is not a single exception, are theories of politics, philosophy, or religion. though all masquerade, albeit with increasing feebleness, like the cockroach disguised as a farmer in Men in Black, as a science of pedagogy. Without an intellectual dimension, you get lost quickly when the spotlight of reality shines on the romantic illusion of forced schooling. It is an exercise in somebody's politics, somebody's philosophy, and somebody's religion. Not mine. As a schoolmaster, I concluded that my kids, rich and poor, had been deprived of their minds, their fundamental constitutional rights, and their ability to sustain the complex relations required if a strong family was to exist. I set out to overthrow the domain of those three ignorances, at least in the universe of my classroom. The natural way to begin doing this is suggested by the structure of institutional schooling itself, because it's the predominant, inescapable fact of most young lives. The standard way for good people inside the system to fight its evil effects is to do the best they can, effect by effect, to bring about something better in their portion of the school equation. Attacking those good people is like kicking Santa Claus, but they are the best friends institutional schooling has, because as long as they exist in small bunches in every school in the land, the myth can be perpetrated that the school idea is basically okay if we could just get more dedicated professionals like Mrs. Magruder or Dr. Factotum. Good teachers who ignore the violence the school structure itself invariably imposes are fellow travelers. Doing the best they can inside the rules allows many others to get away with being good Nazis, for they too are only following orders. There's a way out of this trap. From the beginning of each school year, I made institutional schooling itself the center of my class academic attention. We studied intently the whale which had swallowed us. We examined the role and the character of all of its players. We poked at the assumptions behind each school procedure. It is scarcely possible to keep personal bias out of contrarian undertakings of this sort, but I tried as best I could because I was anxious to be a student of the thing myself, not merely to beat the system. Another thing I did was to try to design escape routes towards certain desirable human qualities that had impressed me in my own life journey. I tried to match individual kids with self-teaching aspects of character training I thought might be useful to them. I've made such a big deal about intellectual matters so far that I should confess no intellect at all entered my catalog of choices. I assembled qualities I had admired in relatives and friends and tried to extrapolate some likely way those qualities had been brought to the surface. So I want you to see my bias openly. My teaching was always a work of intuition, a helix sport, which I'll explain in a minute. For the quality of indomitable rationality, I drew on a friend from boyhood, Ron Hitchon. For persistence, Marty Wallach. I know you don't know these names, but it's important to me to just say them in a public room and pay my debts. For unflappability and strong will, Roland LaGiardi Lara, who's the head of the Poets Cafe in New York City now. For outrageous bravado, my sister. For a model of dialectical mind, my Uncle Frank. For surgical efficiency in speech, my Aunt Virginia. For berserker fearlessness, my granddad, Harry Zimmer. For a sense of fun, beauty, and an appreciation of nature, my mother. For human warmth, my Aunt Laura. For elegance, my Aunt Josephine. For kindness, my Uncle Nick. And for the quality of seeing life is endlessly interesting, my dad. And so on. As long as I remained in the school business and whatever else I built in my practice, intuition lay at the bottom of it all. Not scientific pedagogy. When I speak of our common desperate need for intellect in the kind of society we have inherited, it would be a mistake to think I'm advocating a universe of eggheads like Cambridge or Palo Alto, the vast majority of whom seem to me to be only hired guns for what used to be called darkly the interests, not really human beings at all, but only relays in a system over which they have no say. Wendell Berry might be one of the models I have in mind, or Christiane Northrop, or Mary Loy of the Albany Free School, or Pat Ferenga of Holt Associates. Joe Campbell had no college degree and spent what some would call his formative years as a jazz musician in Paris. Anaïs Nin, who wrote one of the most instructive and fascinating lives of our century and one of its most valuable literary deposits, was, like Campbell, a system of her own. Eric Hoffer, who had a great influence on my own mind, spent virtually his entire life as a day laborer and didn't learn to read until he was 15. In my outlook, Henry Kissinger is no more and may well be less of an intellect than my doorman, Errol Robotham, or my mailman, Hatcher, or Ken Waldenstein, the bulldozer man from Shenango County, who is digging me a pond. Anyone whose mind is actively searching for the profound maps which explain events and people and yourself is on the road to meeting the standard I'm trying to establish. There are countless ways, great and small, to interdict intelligence and intellect and prevent it from developing. But the most effective break I know is to ruin the ability to concentrate. School teaches this negative capability in a variety of ways, like bells. But the least well-understood tactic schools use is to provide a social setting which crackles with menace. Like the peaceful farm mill pond of school biology class notoriety, that under whose tranquil surface everybody's murdering everybody else, even the best schools make an ongoing slaughter of innocents beneath the visible surface of the classroom. Just a few days ago, a 25-year-old woman wrote to me from Tucson this chilling line: "I can hardly say, now that I'm 26, why I began to be so afraid of going to school." I've gotten that letter in the last 5 years 100 times or more. Open your next novel with that line: "I can hardly say, now that I'm nearly 26, why I began to be so afraid of going to school," and half the readers in this country will find their hearts beating faster. My correspondent infers that her disability was a personal thing, but a huge number of us have suppressed the memory of our torment out of spiritual self-protection. Who wants to remember being swallowed alive and taught to feel self-contempt at your own powerlessness and contempt for your parents for their powerlessness to help you? The terror of school's inherent socialization procedures is a matter we will all be compelled to address one day, but as yet it remains terra incognita in the literature. The sabotage of the ability to read challenging texts is the strongest single attack on the development of concentration that school launches. An overwhelming mass of evidence exists from the period of American history prior to forced schooling that strong reading ability is a universal potential and one easily acquired. Somehow the schools set out, particularly after the Second World War, to destroy the ability to read well, and even more, to destroy the inclination to read, which has a more deadly long-range effect. Only 1 in 11 of us, I was told at the Colorado Librarians Convention, reads more than a single book a year after graduation. In my own long classroom experience, even a majority of children who score highly on official reading scales can hardly read at all. I was asked to tell you what I did with my classes, but give me a break. If I told you, that'd throw me in jail. A lot of it was highly illegal, and I'm not sure The statute of limitations just run out. But I'll tell you some things. But I'll tell you some things. First, about the perspective on school children I brought to bear. My kids, as they came to me, had been rigorously classified. I set out to declassify them. But in order for that to take, I found that they needed to comprehend the history, dynamics, and significance of classification itself. My kids had spent half their days in school confinement, missing the vital experience and risk-taking they need to make sense of things. I was determined to unconfine them by hook or by crook, and I didn't care which. My kids had been deliberately and systematically alienated from their families and their private cultures in ways virtually no one teaching school has bothered to understand. I worked to destroy that alienation by attacking its generating ideas dialectically. I gambled that the way to ruin the school machine was to teach dialectics, the challenging of all assumptions. But I made an exception, except those surrounding family, community, culture, and religion. There's a vital need to use a different standard than dialectics to judge those who love you and those to whom duty is owed. I mean, don't pull the dialectic on your mother or your God, or you'll end up with neither. Some more. My kids have been deliberately addicted to the rote memorization of nonsense and deprived of the analytical tools to determine what nonsense it was. Now, there's absolutely, in my opinion, nothing wrong and much right with storing the mind with data and with models to synthesize new reality from and to test yourself against. But the addiction had to be stopped. Stopped and reversed with heavy doses of primary data and heavy-duty comparisons of the real differences often produced by primary data that challenge the conventional wisdom. I'm going to give you one case in point of that. While the New York Times was announcing, this would be several years ago, about 6 years ago, that incumbent mayor Ed Koch was 17% ahead of opponent Dinkins, my teams of 13-year-olds fanning out illegally all over the city took a sample three times as large as the one the New York Times used, and employing the identical mathematical sampling techniques, hardly very formidable to learn when they're actually examined, concluded that Dinkins, not Koch, had a narrow lead. When the new mayor Dinkins assumed office, we smiled, but I presume many New York Times readers looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent on a peak in Darien, Connecticut. That was an allusion to John Keats, who I learned in seventh grade on first looking into Chapman's Homer. Another thing, by the simple expedient of extracting from each kid on the first day of school three things that each one wanted to learn, I mean independent of school, I was able to launch the majority, at least part of the time, on a private, self-selected curriculum, questing for one, then another, of these learnings. As I was writing this, of course it's years after the fact, the ones which come to mind most readily were work as television actors, work in television and print commercials, flying lessons, crossing the Hudson in a rowboat, drifting down the Hudson in a rowboat. I think it was the same kid. He had a rowboat. Manhattan is useless. Drifting down the Hudson in a rowboat on the outgoing tide, building a gun, that was Brian Dentz who built the gun, dressmaking, bicycling from New York to Cape Cod, walking around the perimeter of Manhattan. Isn't that a fascinating idea, that you would follow the perimeter of the island, which doesn't really allow, like the Charles, it doesn't allow you to do that. You sort of have to force your way around. Lecturing to college classes, apprenticing with the governor, a man named Cuomo, becoming a movie reviewer, studying law. Many more would occur if you loosened my tongue with beer. Astonishing results came from letting kids pick their own goals, no matter how absurd or unreasonable those goals sounded. Just as long as you make it clear that you will hold their noses to the grindstone until they give their chosen work a thorough shot, under no circumstances can it be like changing TV channels. Decisions have consequences. But there are a few problems from the kids. Most that arise following this path come from school politics. Emmanuel Pariser of the community school in Camden, Maine, told in his school's annual report last year of paddling a kayak into Penobscot Bay toward a distant island. When he got there and landed on its tiny sand beach, he was worn out. But suddenly, he says, he was overwhelmed by the beauty of wild roses, sparkling sand, rippling waves, and other sights of the remote scene. How strange to feel this way, he thought. I've seen these things many times before. What's the big deal today? Pariser began to think about what makes things beautiful and what makes them interesting, even if they're commonplace. And it seemed to him that working to achieve the island had refreshed his vision. If a cruise ship had dropped him there for a few hours, he might not have appreciated it at all. He realized how important it was that he had gotten there under his own power, with his own paddle, in his own boat. This insight, I think, is the secret that separates those long-married people who look upon their marriages as precious treasures from those who see the bond as a jail sentence. In the former cases, both partners have worked at it. Pariser concluded his essay in the community school annual report, saying, quote, I think a lot about education. My own was like being on a big cruise ship. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know how we were getting there, but I knew I had to keep the officers above me and those at home happy. I never had to help the boat run, and when we finally arrived, it meant so little to me that I never went to any of my own graduations. I think we all value most the learning which we have come to under our own power, the destinations we choose and paddle to. It can't be that simple, can it? That human value has to be generated from inside? If so, we're in trouble because we've built an economy which cannot afford to allow us to think that way. Consider this. 55% of all local government employees are employed in the school game. 45% of all state employees are employed in the school game. Over 60% of your property taxes go to pay for schools. By the way, I cribbed those figures out of a book that was just published over in Amherst, Stephen Aaron, A Short Road to Chaos. Aaron's the guy who wrote Compelling Beliefs, so I really would recommend this book very strongly. If schooling is found irrelevant, an economic catastrophe will occur. The stock market will crash. Bald men will jump out of tall buildings. It can't be that simple. Somewhere between, get ready for this, 7 and 9 million people make their living directly or indirectly or invisibly out of the mass confinement of children in forced schooling. Bianca should count herself lucky. Lucky that she didn't go to school in Germany or Japan, the two best-schooled nations in human history, both of which are previews of the coming attraction in America unless we roll up our sleeves and take Goals 2000 apart, pour a gallon of gasoline under the door of school-to-work legislation and set it alight, and begin in general, this will ruffle some feathers, to take a much more aggressive stance toward the political revolution that has placed the minds of our children in the hands of the corporate state. I do not think that discretion, Robert's rules, or genteel discussions are in order at this particular juncture, unless you want to be the last generation of Americans who retains the right to bring your kids up at home. What a dirty trick to play on your grandchildren. In the current issue of Education Week, the last one before their summer break, so if you get the latest one at your library, you'll get the one I'm referring to. John Goodlad, who has been one of the grand figureheads of holistic schooling for the last 30 years, says that the state has a compelling interest in regulating the goals of homeschooled children. There is the sure sign that you've been doing your work right and have hurt the school monster. He says that ordinary people have been shooting off their yaps in areas where only experts should be heard. The Trilateral Commission calls that an excess of democracy. So you've been warned, as if you should need a warning. The state reached out to Swat Biyanka, and you should not be so starry-eyed at your own success to think it will not come for you unless you reach for your symbolic squirrel rifles first. But the state will fail, we both know that, if you keep your courage and your wits sharp. You need to recognize that the forces at work today to standardize and centralize education and all other aspects of your life are exactly the same ones we fought a revolution against more than 200 years ago. The same dreary people, the ones who think we are permanent children or just machinery to be adjusted, are still in charge. Their argument is seductive and irrefutable. I'm not being sarcastic. They say that an expert exists for everything, one who knows more than you and can make every choice better than you. Who can deny that isn't true? And yet it is a feeble, stupid truth, the truth of a limited mind which itself hates to think, which is angry and terrified that common Americans may rise up to disturb the social order as they once did under Washington and Jackson. In the human ledger, the whole is far greater than the sum of its parts. It is not compounded out of thousands of individual most right decisions, but indeed, it can only exist at all when it is built from inside, when you are allowed to make your own mistakes, when you are not seen as a human resource, don't ever use that foul expression, for someone else to spend, but as a sovereign human being, governments can only oppress at their peril. The idea that the standardizers and centralizers are doing the Lord's work is an ancient one, not amenable to discussion. At the moment, parents and communities are being presented with a time-honored strategy we should call, quote, the fraudulent compromise, in which you are told you will get almost everything you want in exchange for a few concessions. You need only remember how the 1% tax on the rich of 1914 became the 3% tax on all of 1947 and the give me half of everything you have of 1997 to see just how this con is run. The idea is to limit your choices, and if circumstances prevent taking a mile for the moment, then an inch will do. Another strategy as old as Rome is to declare a policy voluntary, but to dangle rich rewards as bribes for those who volunteer quickly, directing ostracism and public scorn against those who do not. Five. A recent issue of the Wilson Quarterly, which is a genuine magazine of intellect, I'd recommend to all of you, discussed the great increase in the number of Americans who practice what are called helix sports, those risky or just bizarre personal undertakings for pleasure which avoid rails, tracks, highways, or confinement to pre-established formal spaces. Among those mentioned were cross-country skiing, gliding, soaring, sailing, snowboarding, skateboarding, motorcycle racing, surfing, mountain climbing, long-distance walking, and I'm not making this up, seatless wilderness unicycling across rough, broken terrain. Try to explain that. What participants appear to be searching for, sometimes at the risk of their lives, is a new relationship to themselves, abandoning conditioned personalities, turning away from the advice of experts who too often upon close inspection turn out to be creeps with unenviable lives themselves. Helix sports are a radical revolt against the timetable, the schedule, and the planned journey. Rearing children properly must be in part a helix sport. To do it well requires courage above all else and the wisdom to understand that no other boy or girl on earth is like yours. The evidence of your own life experience should tell you that the average man and the average woman do not exist. Social science and the various stage theories of child rearing are based on statistical abstractions which are inevitably false when it comes to any particular real child. But like sirens, they continue to tempt you into shoehorning your offspring into the bed of Procrustes. That is what is terrible about excessive formal schooling. It must reenact the drama of that Greek madman. It must make Bianca fit for her own good, even if it kills her. It will come as news only to the young who know no better that we live in a society which has become radically institutionalized. Through the offices of forced schooling, young people are snatched from the arms of their parents and trained to endure this bureaucratic reality. Only radically alienated people will fit into this machinery without breaking it. This is what schools are for, although none of us and few school teachers really want it this way. It's what they do to pay the rent. So what to do? So there are many things, but the problem-solving mind and the intellect are not enough to prevail in the political fight many young parents will face just ahead with Dr. Goodlad's troops, with Goals 2000, and with Schools to Work legislation, and with an implacable, abstract idea run amok to make your Bianca shut up and sit down. I'm going to give you some advice that will not sit well with many of you, but promise me you'll think about it anyway. You need to bloody this thing until it realizes you're not a pushover. You have to say no to it loud and often, or quietly like Herman Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener, who just said, "I would prefer not to," over and over. You need to announce your readiness to hit hard at the real men and women who hide behind this abstraction. You will never bring down the idea itself because it is eternal. But with a warrior spirit, whatever that means to you, and an utter disrespect for the polite forms of contending, which only have value against principled opposition, not systems, you can let it be known you will not scruple to make it hot for any bastard who encroaches on your rights as you define those rights. Hold people personally responsible. That's what Nuremberg did. Do not let officials hide behind their duty or the law. Force them to accept personal responsibility for their decisions. It is much easier to do this than you think. Probably the best way to get along in the short run is to be discreet and bow your head, to compromise, not to make waves. But anyone who gives you this advice has not learned the lesson of Munich, the lesson of the income tax, the lesson of the original 4 months a year government schooling. By appeasement, you proclaim your victim status. Tactically, you may escape in the short run by displaying the white feather, but in the long run, you will be stripped, strapped, and straddled. And that isn't John Gatto talking. It's the accumulated wisdom of the Americans who once understood that liberty is the American dream, not money. I want to quote one of those Americans who most of you will never have heard of, but who was one of the most powerful citizens of the 20th century. He deliberately worked behind the scenes. A man whose life impacted on every life on the planet and still does. The man I refer to is Edward Mandel House of Texas. How many of you ever heard of Edward House? Good. That's the way he would have wanted it. Who inner circle historians believe was the driving force behind America's entry in World War I, the writing of the League of Nations Treaty, one of the most important brokers of the Federal Reserve Act, and was the actual shadow president during
during the Woodrow Wilson years. Whatever you think of House, and I don't much like him, he mastered tremendous human power by understanding human nature. And when I was cleaning out my barn just before I came over here, I found his memoirs. I mean, it's absolutely a treasure. There are only 500 copies printed, and how one got in my barn, I have no idea. In his memoirs, House dismisses his own school days. 3 minutes, Pat. 2.5. By saying he had no interest in my desk tasks because I read much and was learning in a larger and more interesting school. House acknowledges he was a poor student at the bottom of his class. At a school in Virginia where he was sent in 1914 at the death of his mother, he witnessed the kind of hazing that made a lifelong impression on him. Listen to this. Last page, Pat. This is House speaking about the hazing he saw in a Virginia school at the age of 14. One form I recall was that of going through the pretense of hanging. They would tie a boy's hands behind him and string him up by the neck over a limb until he grew purple in the face. Now, House had no mother. His father was far away in Texas, and the school was indifferent to his private fears, as in my long experience it always is. Yet as House wrote in his memoirs, what was done to those who permitted it is almost beyond belief. But he had pride, and he had courage, and he said to himself, I made up my mind at the second attempt to haze me that I would not permit it. I knew there were no limits to the lengths they would go in hazing those who would allow it. It's so vital. Underline that. So I acquired a pistol and a large knife, and with these I held the larger, rougher boys at bay. And the result, they never bothered House again because they knew he had teeth with which to bite back. Don't tread on me, he signaled. I will not permit it. When kids came crying to me because their money had been strong-armed out of them on the playground and asked me to help, I always replied that if they insisted, I would hunt the thieves down and get the money back. Then they will wait for you after school and beat you up for ratting on them, I continued. But let's go if that's what you want. On the other hand, if you choose, you can protect yourself permanently by fighting back as hard as you know how, by going berserk and smashing, striking, biting without regard to your own safety. And when they knock you down, get back up and strike again. No matter how many times they knock you down, get back up and fight. They may win that one time, but I guarantee you, the next time they want a dollar, they'll pick on someone who's an easier mark. And you will have learned something priceless, that the hurt from getting beaten only lasts a little while, but the hurt from quitting without a fight never goes away. Remember, what is done to those who permit it is almost beyond belief. So don't permit it. Tell the animals who run our schooling, shut up, I will not listen. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.